Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity. Each week on the show, I talk to guest experts from the world of integrative medicine for cancer. Doctors, scientists, oncologists, researchers, all types of practitioners, and the occasional expert patient. My guest this week is coming back to the show to talk about the subject of prevention, in particular of breast cancer. Lillian Klein is a highly qualified and experienced nutritional therapist who specialises in supporting women with breast cancer. I'm talking to Lillian over the internet at her practice in Hampshire. Hi Lillian, welcome back to the Yes to Life show.
Thanks Robin, I'm delighted to be here again.
Yeah, lovely to talk to you again. I was recently speaking to Tali Martini on the show. She's the CEO of the charity Breast Cancer UK, which is all about prevention of breast cancer. But today we're going to be talking about exactly that subject, but a bit more from a clinical perspective, as you're on the ground there directly helping women through nutrition and lifestyle. So how come you're so passionate about prevention?
Well, I mean, I think about October being Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and it's always such a great month because there's lots of fundraising, lots of pink ribbons, lots of people doing activities. But historically, there's always been lots of information about in these awareness month in October to examine your breasts for lumps and bumps and how to ensure that you have your regular mammograms and you know what you do if you're diagnosed, etc. But what I very rarely saw was how much less was discussed about how to better inform women about prevention. And we know that, you know, breast cancer is now the most common cancer in women worldwide and the principal cause of it of death of women globally. So just thinking, you know, what can we do to try and prevent this disease? Because I do still see and talk to a lot of women, and they still seem to have kind of a feeling that it's a lottery, you know. And when I say a lottery, I mean it's something that is just happens by chance. And, you know, there's one in seven of us that will develop breast cancer in our lifetimes. That's not even to mention, you know, the risk, there's a small risk to men as well. Mm. And I suppose I like to talk to women about prevention. Unfortunately, in my role as a nutritional therapist, I don't see a lot of women who come to me for prevention. You know, most of the women I'm seeing have already been diagnosed. They're recovering from treatment, or they no longer have cancer and they want to prevent a reoccurrence. But I'm not seeing as much, you know, the odd person here or there who might have a family history of breast cancer, but not so much about the prevention. And in fairness to Breast Cancer UK, actually, they have a breast cancer prevention week. Mm. Inside of that breast cancer awareness. And so they're one of the few people that do actually talk about prevention.
They do.
And it's just not a discussion that is had. And like I said, there's so much going on talking about all these things that we can do if we get breast cancer, but more importantly, what we can do to prevent it. And, you know, I was looking at some statistics actually in advance of this, this chat, and since the 1990s, the breast cancer rates have gone up in the UK by 20%.
Amazing,
and
isn't
I think,
it?
Well, huge. It is, and you know, where does this end? Does, you know, in the next 20 years, is it going to go up more? Is it going to be one in two of us? You know, a 50-50 chance of breast cancer, and. Yeah, I just think that there are lots of things that we can do to support ourselves, you know. And we need to stop the suffering, essentially,
right.
Robin. You know,
right.
You know, I see these women suffering, and you know, they're suffering. You know, not just with the trauma of having a diagnosis, but also with, you know, the long term health issues that come with treatment. That can sometimes go on for months and decades even. You know, you're talking about you know, the short-term things, maybe immune system, gut issues, and then long-term heart damage and lymphedema and all those sorts of things, not to mention the emotional, traumatic issue of being diagnosed with breast cancer.
Yeah, and the permanent worry of it coming back.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, it's massive. This thing about prevention, I think, it's kind of got two sides to it. You have the whole of, medicine and the pharmaceuticals and the most of the charities focused on treatment exclusively. You know, they're not really interested in talking about prevention at all. And then on the other side, you have the public who actually are so frightened, really, of cancer, and it's still such a sort of scary territory that they don't really want to know about cancer until suddenly, bam, it's there in their face, in either themselves or somebody close to them, and then suddenly they have to learn very quickly. And I think, you know, we need to sort of cultivate an environment where it's okay to talk about it, you know, because I mean, it's so ridiculously common. I mean, you gave the statistics for breast cancer, but that's only just breast cancer, you know, one in seven. What about all the other ones as well, which bring us up to one in two, you know? You know, to not be talking about the fact that we're actually extremely likely to get cancer doesn't make any sense. And so prevention needs to be out there as a full-on topic that they're talking about on Woman's Hour. Everywhere you go, it should be in the magazines.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I completely agree with you there. And
it's also about taking responsibility, you know, for our own care. But I do think it starts with education. And there is not enough education. There's not enough information out there to women and reiterated information that they see again and again and again. Mm. You know, even if you go to a breast consultant in the UK, the best you'll get is a leaflet on how to check your breasts, and that's useful and it's helpful. But it's not about, well, what else? What do you do before that? What's the step before that?
Yeah.
And so that is something that I wish there was a lot more of in the country. You know, I still see a lot of people who say to me, well, I don't have a family history of breast cancer, so you know, it's not really something that I have to think about.
Yeah.
And that I find quite worrying as well, because
definitely,
it's such a small proportion of women that are affected by genetic breast cancer. I think sort of something like 5 to 10%, which means that 90 to 95% of breast cancers are not, you know, familiar, and not, they don't have a genetic element.
Right.
So that is concerning, because, you know, I have my clinic. I mean, I very rarely see someone who has a genetic influence for their breast cancer, or a genetic reason for their breast cancer.
Mm.
Most of them have no family history. And that always comes as a surprise to people when I say that to people, when I tell them the figures and I say, look, you know, you need to be aware of this. This is not just if you have a family history. Mm. Yes, it is a factor, but it is a small risk factor. And the vast majority of women don't have a family history. No. You know, we all have some susceptibility to the cancer, to any cancer, but, you know, making, you know, small changes in your daily life influences that risk factor. And that's what people don't seem to know. Mm. And you know, I'm not sure how to get that information out there to people, to make people more aware, so then we can prevent, some of the suffering. I remember going to Truefields years ago, and Sophie Savage was talking.
Right.
And I remember she said, I still remember it, because it stuck with me, and she said, a cancer diagnosis is a challenge for the mind and the body, the heart and the spirit, and by no means just a physical challenge, although too often it's treated as such.
Correct.
And I think about that, and I think about, you know, that encompasses all of what a cancer diagnosis is, you know. It's not just something that is a physical issue. It's so much more than that. And I think on our last interview, I spoke about the trauma involved in having a diagnosis and how it's with you for forever. Mm. You know, you women struggle with that, and that anxiety and that stress and that health, you know, they worry about their health and every ache and pain. And so, you know, it's not just physical, it's so much more than that. And being able to prevent that and be able to prevent more women from having to go through that should be a priority.
Absolutely. So, you know, we're talking statistics there, and yeah, the statistics for incidents relentlessly rise all the time. Of course, the statistics for survival have improved, and that's what we hear so much about. They're trumpeted around like mad, but at the same time, they're not balancing out, well, they're alive, but what else? You know, and you've just described there, the consequences of a diagnosis can be massive, you know, in every way. They can be physically disabling, they can be, you know, completely ruin your life in terms of your confidence and your career and your partnership. Also, it can have such wide-ranging effects. It can be, it's quite scary, really. We should be doing anything we can to avoid putting women through that, because, you know, the fact that the treatments sort of work isn't a good enough reason to allow it to carry on.
Yeah, and there is a hit in the sand. I mean, no one wants to have to think about that. I understand how, you know, you don't want to have to think about giving cancer. You know, it's scary for people. But if we, you know, if some of the cancer charities, and I mean, they do a great job and they raise money and they raise awareness, and that's great, you know. I'm not going to get into this today, but I always still see the cake sales, you know, all the cake
yes, those cake sales.
We won't even go there.
No, right.
You know, it raises money, and I see and I understand that. And yeah, so I do think that somewhere along the line there needs to just be, it is better, Robin. I mean, you can see that there's improvements. You know, years ago they didn't talk about prevention. You know, I used to watch breast cancer awareness, and that there was never a prevention part to it. It just wasn't discussed. And, you know, now we have people talking about prevention in Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So this is all good. This is all positive. It's just, I suppose, want to see it a little bit more.
Amazingly slow. That's the problem. The change, the rate of change. Need the foot on the gas. We've got an epidemic here of cancer.
Yeah, and like you say, the rates are going up and up, and of course, then people are also reliant on tools like mammograms, and I mean, just this year for me, I've had a number of clients who've had an all clear from a mammogram, only to discover, a couple of months later, or in one instance, I had a lady this year who had a mammogram in July, and in August she found a lump. She went back to the doctor and she had stage 3 breast cancer.
Wow.
So, and this is happening more and more, and I suppose people are also, you know, saying, well, you know, if I have a mammogram, then that's me done. That's, you know, I don't worry about it for X amount of time. But mammograms are not infallible, you know. I was talking, was it last week, the week before, I was talking to a breast radiographer, and we were discussing the best ways to check for breast health, and she was saying that she sees lots of referrals from women who have been to see their doctors. The doctors have found maybe some lumps and bumps and then sent them on for a mammogram or an ultrasound or whatever. And she said, but really, every woman has lumps and bumps, and we have lumps and bumps at different times of the month. So knowing your own breasts is the most important thing, because, you know, a doctor can always, or somebody else can often find a lump, but that's normal, a normal lump for us. But we need to know our breasts better, and we need to be checking them regularly. And she's saying that's the best screening tool that we have, is to regularly be checking our own breasts. But then I often talk to women about that, and they say they don't like to do it, because they're scared.
Right.
They're scared that they might find something, and that would be terrifying.
Yeah.
So they don't check their breasts because they don't want to find anything. So, yeah, it's a tricky one.
It is tricky. That's a bit of a sort of man's approach to health, that one, I have to say. That's usually how men operate, is don't look and it'll probably be all right. it's difficult, but it's interesting to hear what they're saying there, that actually that's the best diagnostic tool, really, being aware of yourself. So, that's a strong message.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
How good are vitamin C supplements? Usually only a small proportion of vitamin C actually reaches your cells and has a positive effect. Whereas the high absorption levels of Goldman Laboratories liposomal vitamin C help maintain optimal vitamin C levels in your body and strengthen your immune system. Now get 10% off when you choose Goldman Laboratories liposomal vitamin C capsules. Just quote 10 off at goldmanlaboratories.com.
Do you suffer from pain? B-Cure Laser, a home-use CE-approved medical device for the effective treatment of pain, is now available in the UK. The results of a double-blind trial has shown that B-Cure Laser offers a significant reduction in pain compared to the placebo group. To get your special B-Cure offer now, call free on 0808 501 5122 or Google Radio Pro London. B-Cure Laser.
The station that makes you feel good.
So I just want to come back to you. You talked about the way that breast cancer looks like a bit of a lottery, you know, and it just seems to randomly happen to anyone. So I think that kind of props up the temptation to avoid the subject and hope for the best. But I think you definitely seem to see it otherwise. I mean, it's actually been spoken about publicly by people who should know better as being just bad luck in recent years. What do you think the situation is really?
Well, we all know it's not well. I mean, you say it's not a lottery. Occasionally I get somebody who shouldn't, in my eyes, have breast cancer. You look at their genetics and they're good and they are perfect, you know, they're not overweight, they don't drink, they exercise plenty, and you look at them and you think, you're not that candidate, you know, there's a lot of risk factors and they don't tick any of those boxes, but right. Yet they still have breast cancer. So this does happen, and it happens with any disease, you know, so, but mostly we know that we can influence the risk. There are lots of things that we can do. And I hope that, you know, towards the end of the call, I can leave the listeners with some, just a few points just to think about.
Sure.
That are key, you know, just, there's lots of things. There's many, many ways to reduce our risks, but just sort of some key points just to think about. And if you could put some of those things into place, that they would influence and reduce your risk. So it generally isn't a lottery. It isn't a lottery. It's not just something that happens by chance. But like I said, occasionally you get someone who just doesn't tick any of the boxes and yet still has breast cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, the kind of percentage which is allotted to lifestyle factors and the environment seems to go relentlessly up. I mean, you know, that's amongst the more establishment figures I'm talking about. I mean, I think many people have put them much higher than the establishment a long time ago, the effect of pollutants and lifestyle choices and that kind of thing. But they are actually climbing up all the time in the kind of public figures as well. I think eventually we're going to decide that maybe you've got the 5 or 10%, which you were handed, you know, by your parents in a genetic weakness, which you didn't do anything about. And then all the rest might be lifestyle and environment.
Yeah.
Where else does it come from?
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's, you know, like I said, there's so many factors that, you know, talking about the environment and talking about diet and talking about lifestyle, absolutely, that's sort of standard now for most cancers. There are risks that we can increase and that we can decrease, and we have control over those. You know, we can make those changes or not make those changes, and we can bury our head in the sand or not. And I think you kind of almost have to grip this, take it, grab it by the shoulders and go, you know what, not just about cancer, but about all diseases. You know, these are things that can reduce all-cause mortality. These are things that, across a wide spectrum of diseases and chronic diseases and general diseases, day-to-day things, you know, even reducing your risks of complications with things like COVID, taking better care of ourselves. And, you know, we live in a fast-paced world with easy food and lots of toxins and lots of stress and processed food. And if you don't stop and take a breath and look at how you're living your life and how you're building your body and the foods you're building your body with, you know, you could find yourself in a predicament where you are not well. And, you know, when you're younger, you know, people tend to be resilient. As we get older, we tend to be less resilient. And it's that when little creaks start to show. You know, people get into their sort of 40s and 50s and suddenly you find little things are not working quite as well as they should. And, well, I think it's, you know, it's about being proactive rather than being reactive, which is what most people are.
Right. Well, you know, in my experience, there's two things that prompt change. I'm thinking about me personally. And one of those is a shock, and the other one is education. There's the drip, drip, drip of education I do find has its effect. You know, there are many things that in the early days of Yes to Life I would have thought were just being over the top, you know, worrying about those things. Now I won't go anywhere near them because I've learned a lot about them. So that has actually worked. And I've also had change has been prompted by a shock as well. And well, we don't want to shock everybody into change. So it has to, out of those two, it has to be education. I don't know any other routes that actually really work. Telling people that they ought to change their habitual diet, it's their comfort food they've had since day one, because it's a good idea, is usually not enough. They need to be told, look, you're just about to die. And then they might. But I don't know if you know, got any other sort of routes to success with inspiring changes in lifestyle?
I wish I did, Robin. I wish I had answers, but it's exactly as you described. Most of the people that I see, it's shock. That's their motivation. That's, yeah, you know, they have their mortality thrown in front of them.
Yes.
And suddenly, you know, their life has been, with pandemonium, life has changed. Their life as they knew it has changed. That motivates people. And like you said, the thing about the drip-drip education, because sitting here and telling people and saying, you know what, eat your five a day or whatever, doesn't work. People don't do it. Because there's no instant effect. You know, if you didn't eat your five a day and you grew a big red boil on the end of your nose, the next day you would eat your five a day.
Yeah.
But the body doesn't work like that. So because there's no instant effect, people just, they don't make those changes until they have to make those changes.
Mm.
I don't know, maybe there's some psychology out there, maybe there's some psychologists who've got better ideas and ways that you could make people see. I think, you know, when you have a loved one, when you have somebody who's ill and you see, I mean, part of the breast cancer awareness is the fact that most people know somebody who's had breast cancer or have a family member or friend. So a lot of awareness comes from that. And then seeing what they've gone through, that sometimes motivates people. But once again, it's coming back to that shock element. You know, and there is definitely an education. There's definitely education lacking, because I talk to people all the time and I say, okay, there's things we need to think about. You're looking at people's diets, looking at their lifestyles, and I'm telling them what they need to be doing, giving them information, and they're genuinely surprised. Clearly that information wasn't, that education wasn't available to them.
Right.
Or they were looking, well, they maybe probably weren't looking for it, but you think about, you know, the way that breast cancer awareness is everywhere. You know, there's pink ribbons here, it's on the internet, it's on Google, it's everywhere. So it's almost that sort of thing where you need to have it in people's minds all the time when they go to the grocery store, when they go on to the internet, when they're looking for things, just, you know, in the doctor's surgeries, everywhere. It needs to just be all around them, so that, you know, you think about how much money could be saved on the NHS if prevention, you know, if more prevention money was spent on marketing and telling people about prevention and educating people. You know, there'd be a fortune saved on things, basic things like diabetes and heart disease and cancers and all of these diseases, high blood pressure, etc., etc., etc. You know, most, you know, it was a thing on the BBC, it was some years back, and I can't remember exactly, but they were saying that a group of GPs had said that they thought that 80% of the problems that were coming through their consulting rooms could be resolved with diet and lifestyle.
I'm sure it's true.
That's significant.
Yeah. Well, that's the era we're in. That's the kind of health problems we're having to deal with. And yeah, they seem, you know, we've got, in other ways, of course, our health has improved a lot because we're not dying of simple infections and things that people used to die of in the past. But we're living these incredibly unhealthy lives, which where we degenerate. And, you know, the quality of life, by the time you're on, you know, 10 different drugs, is not that great, basically. And it's kind of just being kept going somehow. But I think there could be very much more done in the way of education very much earlier. I mean, it's clear that, you know, the younger generation at the moment are becoming aware of the environment very quickly because they've got reason to. And the information's out there. There's a lot going on in that way. But, of course, this is just another part of the same issue. It's all the same issue of what we do to our food, what we do to our environment, and how our health is. They're all directly linked and the same problem.
Yeah, no, I have to agree with you. I mean, things are changing for young people. Just, you say they're more aware, and I see a lot of less kids smoking now than did years ago.
Yes.
But those habits are now changed with others, you know. So they've stopped smoking out, and now we have an epidemic of mobile phone and you know, kids are attached permanently to their mobile phones.
Yes.
And the risks that's associated, you know, with that. You know, maybe years and years ago, I think in my parents' generation, they all smoked, and everybody, you know, everybody dabbled in smoking.
Yeah.
But then there wasn't as much of the fast food, and now there's a lot more fast food, and there's a lot more easy access to this food. So it's changing, it swings in roundabouts. But in general, the kids are more aware. And maybe, you know, maybe our children and our children's children will see the world in a different way. Maybe smoking and excessive alcohol drinking and healthy food, maybe these will all be changes that we can see in the future. I'm not sure it's going to be in my lifetime.
Mm. Well, a lot of it needs to happen very soon, and the pressure's on. So, coming back to breast cancer, you mentioned at the beginning about this quite small proportion of women who get breast cancer have got family history that there's actually, a genetic issue going on. And I think one of the reasons that maybe there's more awareness about that than about the huge percentage of the people who don't have that is because of the media, of course, is that they've sensationalised that whole thing in the last 10 years with a few very high-profile figures responding to the news that they've got, BRCA2 gene or whatever it is. And this has splashed all over the tabloids and has made, in a way, generated a sort of complacency that you described, I think, in the women who think, oh, well, at least I haven't got that, you know, I'm all right. And that's really, as you pointed out, it's far from the case, actually. And it's actually a bit of false security thinking that that doesn't apply to you, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing that compounds that is that whenever a woman goes into an appointment and he's worried about breast health, the first question that gets asked is, do you have family history? And when they say no, then it's almost like, okay, well, you don't have a family history, so then it's okay.
Yeah.
And I think that's a problem as well, because yes, it is a question to be asked, but it's not the only question to be asked.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like you say, that gives a false sense of complacency because, okay, well, I don't have a family history, but yes, but they are still, I'm still at risk of breast cancer, so we shouldn't just leave it at that. I think that the way it's asked is often, and I've been had that experience of that myself. You know, that's always a first question that is asked, and then if you answer no, then it's okay. Well, then if you had a family history, then it'd be very serious. Then we look into maybe a bit more detail. But because you don't, it's not really worried. And I do sometimes worry. Does a medical profession know these statistics? Do they know that actually it's such a small proportion of women that actually, I don't know that.
I know, I'm not sure.
You would think so, but I don't know.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, there tends to not be the buildings on fire kind of response from the medical profession, I feel. I think it's something to do with doing this stuff day in, day out, like a sort of factory processing women with breast cancer, you know, that's what they do. And it's kind of normal. It's not like, oh my God, this is a terrible, terrible situation that needs responding to. And all too often you get a kind of underplayed response to what turns out to be something very serious that can be the consequence. I mean, you hear that story far, far too often, that somebody has gone back and gone back and gone back, even being called completely neurotic, and then being diagnosed far too late by, you know, this sort of complacency that seems to exist within cancer care. Well, we need this sense of urgency somewhere, so it doesn't seem to be, as I say, in the public or in the profession, really. It's on both sides.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Galar Light is the quantum energy emitted from the universe, from the sun and stars. Now, Tom Palladino, a humanitarian and Scalar Light researcher, has created the world's only Scalar Light healing system, a system that can bring long-distance healing and wellness to humans, pets, and plants via a photograph. Get your free 15-day trial now at scalarlight.com or click on the Scalar Light banner on the UK Health Radio website.
Shields like masks are top of mind right now, but did you know you have inner armor working constantly to protect you from pathogens? It keeps you healthy and thriving. It's your immune system. Ion Gut triggers the body's natural ability to support gut strength all year long, so your immune system can protect you when you need it the most. How are you treating your inner armor? Visit uk.ionbiome.com to learn more. Ion Gut. Protect what protects you.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a client recently who was young, and she went to the doctor for a period of a year, saying that, you know, she felt something in her breast, and he said, "Oh, I'm sure it's just a cyst." And she had breast cancer, but wasn't taken seriously because she was young and she didn't have a family history.
Right.
So, you know, and I see this all the time. I see this in varying degrees. I see people coming to me with having mammograms and then finding that they had cancer, and then all young and then being dismissed because they're young.
Yeah.
It's still happening, you know, and we know really that, yes, young people get breast cancer. You know, young children get cancer of all descriptions. So it's not something that is so unusual now. It's becoming more and more common. And another thing that I'm seeing, and that I wanted to actually make a particular point to mention today, was that I'm seeing, talking to women with dense breasts and trying to impress upon people the importance of knowing what their breast density is, because it's an important piece about breast health. And I noted that very few women know what their breast density is and the risks that are associated with it. They hear lots about it, but they aren't exactly sure what it means or how it impacts them. And they don't know what their breast density is. And the only way you can know what your breast density is if you have a mammogram. So you can't feel your breast and know whether you've got a dense breast or not. So you would actually, so it would be once you've had your first mammogram that you would be able to ask a question of what your breast density was. And breast density just really means, you know, the fiber and the glandular tissue in the breasts compared with the amount of fatty tissue in the breasts. So, you know, it's common, you know, sort of probably around, I don't know, 50% of women have dense breasts. But the problem is that dense breasts can hide cancer on the mammogram. So, you know, if you went onto Google and you just you're asked to have a look at a mammogram of a dense breast versus a non-dense breast. What you would see is that the mammogram shows the dense breast is sort of like this white, it's like a white colour, and tumours are very similar. So what can happen is you have this dense breast and you've got a tumour somewhere within that. It's really hard to tell the difference between the tumour and the dense breast. So a tumour can easily be missed. So the problem is that the reason I wanted to bring it up is because I have seen a number of clients this year with this very problem. And so it's fresh in my mind, and it's just something that I want to make women aware of, that if you go for a mammogram, ask the radiographer what your breast density is. You know, in parts of the world, you have to be told what your breast density is, and this, if you have dense breasts, then you get sent on for additional testing, different types of testing. Not so much in the UK. So ask what your breast density is. You start from a very fatty breast to a very dense breast, and there's four different levels, and mm-hmm. they should be able to tell you where you are on that level.
Right.
And then once you have that information, if you, for example, have a dense breast, and they say you have very dense breast, then there are other options. So then your standard mammogram is just a 2D image of your breast. But if you have dense breast, then there's a different type of mammogram which can be better to view the tissue and breast, dense breast. And that's called tomosynthesis, and it's a 3D image of the breast. So it's a better option. And often for my clients that have had this done, what they normally do is they'll do this 3D mammogram and then they couple that up with an ultrasound, because even a 3D is not infallible. So adding the ultrasound as an additional check to the tomosynthesis. So, but first of all, you've got to know you've got dense breasts. And so the reason I'm saying it is because a number of the people who've come to see me this year who've had a mammogram and then found out shortly afterwards that they've had a more advanced breast cancer that clearly would have been there for a while, have all had dense breasts. And it's only when I've asked, have they looked at the mammograms and said, yes, it did say that I have dense breasts. Mm. And it's just something that women need to be aware of, you know. I mean, I've had people say to me, well, what contributes to having this dense breast tissue? And it's a number of factors. I think, you know, genetic is some element of it. Also, if you're on hormonal treatments, HRT or the pill or something, coil or something like that, then you can have more, your breast can be a bit more dense. Sometimes when people lose weight, and you know they've gone from having quite fatty breasts and they lose weight, and then they can end up with more fatty tissue, more dense breasts because they lose the fatty tissue. So there's a number of different factors, but it is a risk factor and not only because you don't see it easily on a mammogram, but also because there's some theories, and they're a bit vague really, but I think it's got to do with the fact that you've got more glandular tissue and there's more cells, so they're more active, and possibly a link to, you know, they could potentially be releasing more estrogen, and that could lead to problems. So it's just something that I wanted to make sure that
people understand. Today,
so that more women who go for mammograms actually ask the questions. You know, because I've had some of my clients also say to me, well, what about thermography? Should I not be having, you know, the mammograms? Because then there's also radiation and long-term radiation and that sensitive area, and what should I do about that? And I'm a nutritional therapist, I'm not a doctor, and I can't advise on those things. But what I have seen is that I've got clients who've gone for thermography, and then they've said, just so you know what thermography is, it's non-invasive, there's no radiation, and it's basically thermal imaging that uses heat, which looks at the increased metabolic activity. So it's becoming more popular, and I see more people that have had thermography, and then they might be told on from the scan that there is some activity and they need to keep an eye on it, and then they worry and they go, well, there's some heat, there's some heat changes on this scan, and so what do I do with that? So then they go off to their breast surgeon and they say, oh, I've had this and it showed some activity, and they poo-poo it and they go, well, it's rubbish. And then they'll say, well, you know, the person will be insistent and say, well, I want to have a mammogram or something, and the mammogram shows nothing, and they say, I told you, it's nonsense. So it's not that it's nonsense, it's that sometimes it can detect things really early, and then what do women do with that information? Mm. That's sometimes a worry, because now they know that there's some heat changes, there's something there, potentially, but it's nothing that's actionable with medicine, because they can't see anything. So yeah. There's nothing there, so they won't do anything about it, and so they poo-poo it, and they say it's nonsense. Until they can see the cancer, there's nothing they can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is fine if you've got somebody who is, who has got, there's a lot of lifestyle changes that you can make, because, you know, then you can start thinking about all the different nutrients that they need for breast health, and just about supporting inflammation in the body, and generally supporting their breast health. But then you have somebody else, and I've had somebody like this recently, which makes me think about it, who's doing all of these things, who's got this fantastic diet, who is really healthy, and had a thermoscan, and gets told that there's some metabolic activity there, and they go off and go and say, well, I want to have this checked out, and there's nothing there, and they're doing all of these lifestyle changes already. What do they do with that information?
Stuff.
It's scary. And I'm not saying, you know, it's just, I'm just throwing it out there. I'm just saying, so what I think is, from what I can gather from reading, is that actually to have a thermography, but then also have it alongside, like an ultrasound or something like that, might be more helpful. It's not my area of expertise. It's just stuff I've encountered along the way. And you know, I like the idea of a thermography. I think it's great. But then it's where you go with that.
I understand. So you're right. It's quite scary. If you say that the proportion of women who've got dense breasts might be as big as 50%, the fact that there's a standard scan getting applied to all women is supposed to give the same result, doesn't quite make sense if it doesn't really work very well with dense breasts. That seems to be a major flaw in the program. But certainly something to make women aware of, as if they think they're getting a sound result from it.
Well, yeah, I think it's that complacency where you've had your mammogram and now it's all okay. And I'm not trying to scare people, because most women, you know, they'll pick up if there is anything. But what I'm just trying to make aware is that if you don't know your breast density, it's often you won't be told. In fact, you won't be told. I haven't yet met a client who has had dense breasts who's been told that they have dense breasts. So it's only when you look at the scan results and you read the reports that you see that they have the dense breasts. And I think it's a question that we just need to get into the habit of asking.
Right. Okay. So, we're just coming towards the end. So I just want to come back to the prevention. It looks like to me it has kind of two facets. There's targeted prevention based on known tendencies or exposures or personal history. And then there's the kind of broad inclusive steps that apply to huge numbers of women and therefore make sense as general recommendations. And I just wonder if you'd like to give us your short list of top tips for either grouping.
Yeah, okay. So in terms of tips that I would give the general public, so not specifically people who already have breast cancer, but people who are looking to reduce their risks of breast cancer, these are not going to be tips that you haven't already heard before, especially if you're a listener to this show. But watching your weight, making sure that you're not overweight. Fat tissue is more metabolically active, and so it can increase your chances of getting breast cancer, because it can raise your estrogen levels. So having more fat cells in your body can raise estrogen levels. And if you develop an estrogen or progesterone hormone positive, with a hormone positive driven cancer, obviously that can be that can be a problem. And also the other hormone, insulin, you know, high insulin levels have been linked to some cancers, including breast cancer. So watching your weight, because that's an important consideration. I think my second one would be, and I'm not in any particular order, is, you know, moving your body. So, you know, the research is abundant. Right. You know, we're talking about, you know, in terms of outcomes, in terms of people who already have cancer or who are recovering, about reoccurrence rates, about prevention in altogether. Exercise comes up every time, you know. And I think it's about, you know, a lot of people have this attitude that they might have to go and spend, you know, hours in the gym, but it's really just about being vertical and doing something, you know, not just sitting and sitting in front of the TV and sitting at your desk and sitting at the dinner table and lying in your bed. It's about moving your body. So I just, you know, we're all at different levels in terms of activity, and for some people it might be just, you know, walking around the block. For others, it might be running a marathon. I don't know. You know, it's just all variations of that. But whatever you're doing a bit more.
Right.
So the next thing would probably be food. Like I said, not in any particular order. You know, that rainbow, that thing that you get told about all the time, about eating the reds and the greens and the yellows and the oranges. You know, it's the most powerful medicine known to humankind, and it has the ability to literally switch genes on and off. So, you know, I think, you know, especially if you, well, not especially, but if you have cancer, I think it's also, you know, food is something that you can kind of take ownership of and be empowered by, because it feels like for a lot of my clients, they say, you know, it's the one thing that they can do for themselves,
right.
During, after treatment, etc. So the food you eat is very important. Alcohol, avoiding alcohol. Alcohol increases estrogen, not to mention the fact that it can damage DNA, it can affect the gut, it can affect the liver. I am pleased to say that there's a lot more people out there that don't drink now. I've made a conscious life choice not to drink.
Mm.
And there's also some great non-alcoholic drinks.
Well, that's part of it. Yeah, it's good options, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah, there's some great ones. Mm. So that's been wonderful. Mm. And I think, you know, back to the point you talked about earlier about environment, chemicals and stuff like that, I think my last point would be that you need to think about what you put on your skin and what chemicals are in your environment and how they can influence your risk of getting breast cancer. You know, some of them damage your DNA, and others are known as endocrine disrupting chemicals, so they affect your hormones, and they're found in everything, you know, from your cleaning products to the furniture in your house. And so we're just trying to minimize some of those. So yeah, I mean, I suppose just getting our, that was my last point, but just to say that I have this little sign up in my office that says the greatest wealth is health. And I look at
True.
It and I remind myself of that. I remind my clients of that, and encouraging, you know, mothers, grandmothers and fathers to educate their daughters so that they can live their lives and not impacted by this, by the risk of reducing their risks of breast cancer.
Mm. Mm. Right, okay, well, a good note to end on there. Thank you. Yes, passing it on to our children, we are so influential in what happens to the next generation. That's the most important thing we're doing, in a way, is bringing up the next generation. So yeah, what better for them to bring change. Thank you very much indeed, Lillian.
You are very welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, lovely to talk to you.
Bye.
Lillian certainly had some powerful messages for women when it comes to avoiding the immense suffering that comes with the diagnosis of breast cancer. Many thanks for listening today. I sincerely hope that many of you gained some useful information, and I hope you'll want to make a point of joining me again next week for another Yes Live show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.
Mm-hmm.